The proxy statement has a lot of information for investors so that they can make informed decisions when it's time to vote.
You are listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode. I'm Steve Odlin from the Conference Board and the host of this series. And in today's conversation, we're going to discuss the results to date of the 2024 proxy season. Joining me today is Merrill Sperrings, senior researcher for the ESG Center and the author of the recent report from the Conference Board on this year's season. Merrill, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so you know, Merrill, most of our listeners are probably familiar with the proxy, but for those who aren't, what is a proxy, and you know, what companies have to issue them and so forth?
Here in the US, public companies have an annual meeting every year. They have their shareholders vote on various issues. Some issues are brought up by the company or by management. We call those company proposals. And some issues are brought up by shareholders. We call those shareholder proposals. And so at the annual meeting, shareholders vote on both company proposals, and those include, for example, the re-election of directors. Also, they have to approve their executive compensation packages. We call that say on pay. And so there are a variety of company proposals. And then the shareholder proposals, and that's the interesting part, those are the issues raised by shareholders, and they request companies to take action or to disclose information on certain issues. So that together will be put in what we call a proxy statement. And so the proxy statement has a lot of information for investors so that they can make informed decisions when it's time to vote. Now, almost 90% of annual meetings for public companies take place between April and June or beginning of July. So we call that the proxy season, just because that's where the majority of all these annual meetings take place. So when we say proxy season, we refer to basically that period, but we also talk about, you know, just 2024, 2023 as a full year. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, so it's like going to the voting booth for, you know, for any election. This is voted by proxy, since they don't usually vote in person, so it allows them to vote in paper and ahead of time. So that's the proxy piece of it. And this is all statutory. It's required by law.
Yeah.
That they have an annual meeting and that they have these proposals and they vote on them and they vote on the directors. So
Correct. It's something
that happens every single year. Okay, so now you've just released this proxy season preview report. What are the major themes that you see?
Yeah, so in some ways, 2024 really is a continuation of what we saw last year. So we're seeing a high volume of shareholder proposals, many going to a vote. So and we'll touch on that later, but when a shareholder proposal is filed, it can be so that a proponent is a shareholder submitting the proposal. They can negotiate a withdrawal, or the company can have it omitted by the SEC through its no action relief process. And we can touch on that a little later, but if a proposal goes to a vote, that's really where it gets interesting. So many of these proposals this year are going to a vote, more so than last year. And a majority are addressing environmental and social issues rather than governance and executive compensation issues. And once again, and this is really good news for companies, average support is declining. And that has happened now for 3 years in a row. What is different this year from last year, and this is what we've heard from our members, so governance executives at leading companies, as well as from investors, is that there's a bit of a randomness to this year's proxy season. There's a sort of like a scattershot feel to it. You think that proponents, like I said, those are the shareholders that submit their proposals at the companies. You think that they would be discouraged after a couple of years now of declining support for their proposals. But on the contrary, they are, in many instances, they are adjusting their approaches. For example, they find new ways They try different angles for issues that they've raised before, and they are adopting new issues. Now, other proponents are using the proposals as a bait and switch, where the proposal is addressing one topic, but they basically want to discuss an entirely different topic with the company. And others are submitting proposals that are addressing issues that are not even really... It's almost like they're in search for issues at certain companies. And then finally, and this is, again, what we've heard from our members, some proposals, they just lack a clear rationale altogether. So that's really a little different from previous years, that randomness, and that you know, companies are not really sure what proponents are trying to accomplish. So some of the same and some different from...
Yeah, but, you know, it's logical that there would be less, you know, just more, you know, different kinds of proposals, because we've had decades now of shareholders and activists submitting proposals every year to these companies on basic governance items and so forth. And for the most part, the large public companies have gotten their everything consistent with what shareholders and what governance experts want. So now we're getting more into other themes that, you know, we haven't seen. It's not the traditional basic governance themes as much. It's other themes. Describe what you're seeing and you know, what kinds of themes.
We specifically talk about governance proposals, and then as a subset, and then we talk about ENS proposals. Those are the environmental and the social proposals. As you said, the governance proposals are those address the more traditional governance areas, such as chair-CEO separation, bylaw amendments, supermajority vote requirements, the ability to call special meetings, so really shareholder rights. And then in the past couple of years, the other proposals that have become, well, and in at least in volume, very popular are those on ENS and human, so E, environmental, S, social, and human capital management proposals. And those go from climate-related topics, so that's emissions mostly, to deforestation, to plastic pollution, so that's the environmental proposals. Then when it comes to human capital management, a big chunk of the proposals there is on diversity, and then mostly workforce diversity. There's also proposals this year actually saw increasing levels of employee health and safety and workforce conditions. So that's the human capital management category. And then social proposals ranges from lobbying, political spending, human rights, animal rights. Well, you get it. Like all social proposals that we read about in the news, that's what companies are getting in proposal form as well.
Yeah. Now, the environmental side has really picked up, I think, since, you know, some of these recent agreements, including the Paris Accord, where countries increasingly are agreeing to get to zero carbon by 2050. And so you see a lot of shareholder pressure and activist pressure on public companies to disclose what they're doing, at least disclose what they're doing, and then go beyond that and to cut carbon. And so it all goes hand in hand with what we're seeing out there in the political environment.
Correct. Yes, that's very correct. Now, it is very interesting. So what a trend, and I just touched on it, but what we're seeing are increasing levels of proposals. But in recent years, in I think the last three, well, this is the third year now of declining support for these proposals. So the volume has gone up, support has gone down. And there are several factors. And for example, just as an example, environmental proposals, currently, or as of yesterday, average support was 12% for environmental proposals versus 21% of average support in all of 2023 and 35% in all of 2022. And so, and you see similar patterns for social proposals and human capital management proposals. There are a couple of reasons, and this is again what we've heard from our members and from investors. Well, no, this is what we heard from investors. We convened a roundtable with investors representing over 15 trillion in assets under management, and what they let us know is that they see that these proposals have become more prescriptive. So whereas in the past they asked to disclose certain information, they have now shifted to asking companies to take specific action, and sometimes even strategy altering actions. So that's just something that investors find, you know, too prescriptive, micromanagement, or just intervening with the company's daily or ordinary business. So that's one reason. Another reason also is companies have become better, as you mentioned, you know, spurred by upcoming regulation and investor expectations. Companies have really improved their disclosures and their data on ESG topics. They still receive some of these proposals that just ask for like adjustments of their reporting, but investors don't see that that's really necessary at this point for many companies.
Yeah, so I think it goes back to, you know, the companies have adopted these you know, widely regarded and widely accepted frameworks of disclosure. Mm-hmm. So that that checked that box and you know, satiated that need. But then you're right, you do have these proposals that are a little more esoteric and in some cases challenge the business model. So you have fossil fuel firms being, you know, challenged to exit fossil fuels, which is kind of hard to do when that's the business that you're in, and
yes,
and it's still required. But so this is why you're seeing, you know, more varied proposals, but mm-hmm. also more support, because, you know, investors are saying, well, look, you know, we don't want them to exit their business model, you know, based on what's going on. They've got to demonstrate where they're going over time. But mm-hmm. so anyway, it's that sort of thing which is driving the results to date.
Yeah, exactly. And the proposal, or that type of proposal, what you just mentioned, that also can really lead to unintended second order effects, as we call it, because these proposals at major U.S. banks or financial institutions that call for restricting underwriting or lending to oil and gas companies, what can happen is that even though it looks like that's, you know, an environmentally responsible proposal, it could shift activities or assets to less regulated or less responsible entities. And so by, you know, if you were to implement that proposal, you, instead of reducing risk, you're actually increasing risk.
Yeah. Now, the social issues are interesting because, you know, you're really getting CEOs and boards of directors sucked into the political theater, which mm-hmm. is not historically what has happened. And so by asking them to take a social position,
yeah,
you know, in most cases they're, you know, you have to think about the multi-constituency world, customers, employees, owners, community. But we are, you know, not monolithic as a society, and everybody mm-hmm. has their own opinion. So it, by definition, if a company takes a stand on a social issue, A, it may not be, you know, have anything to do with their business. So it's like, well, why are you commenting on it? And then B, you run the risk of offending half of your customers, half of your employees, and half of your owners. So this whole area is fraught with risk.
It is. It is absolutely. Like you said, companies have been under growing pressure to address social issues, but there are so many challenges in addressing these issues. One of them, indeed, like you said, the backlash from both ends or both sides of the political aisle. But it's also whether or not you have consistent process and criteria and whether you're following through or any on any of those stands. We put out a report how companies can decide whether and how to respond to social issues. Now, if a company gets a social proposal, that's sort of a proposal on a social topic, that sort of deprives the company from, you know, as to whether they should respond, because they are basically forced to respond. What they still can decide is how to respond to an issue, because there are multiple ways that companies can respond to social issues. Obviously, they can employ employment initiatives or deploy in employment initiatives. They can take a stand. They can engage with government officials, and so what they want to do is really have criteria to understand like how are we going to respond. A couple of these criteria should be like, what are the company's resources And is there an ability to follow through? Does the company have the resources to follow through on the statement? And then it's also important to see what the track record of a company has been, because you do want some level of authenticity, you know, in your response.
We're talking about the 2024 proxy season. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
What does the future of work mean for your employees? How will your company navigate ESG? Will there be a global recession? At the Conference Board, our experts translate the latest research and economic analysis into insights and real-time problem-solving for your organization. Membership at the Conference Board provides your team with an assortment of knowledge from economics, marketing and communications, ESG, public policy, and human capital. As a member, you'll have access to our center experts, member-exclusive events, data and benchmarking tools, and peer sharing that will help you understand the present and shape the future. Consider becoming a Conference Board member today by visiting www.conference-board.org.
I'm your host, Steve Odlin from the Conference Board, and I'm joined today by Meryl Sperrings, Senior Researcher for the ESG Center of the Conference Board. So, Meryl, you know, just a little bit ago, we had this whole Supreme Court decision in the SFFA versus Harvard case, which is having an impact on proposals well beyond the academic sector. Talk about the ruling and what you're seeing as it relates to shareholder proposals now.
Yeah, so that was a landmark decision of the Supreme Court in which it held that race-based affirmative action programs in college admission processes violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So it's interesting because this decision technically doesn't apply to companies. But what we do see is that companies are embracing a more inclusive approach in response to the decision. Companies are embracing a more inclusive approach to diversity, which goes beyond race, ethnicity, and gender. And they are increasingly viewing diversity as something that everybody brings to the table. And some companies are also more explicitly describing how diversity links to company performance. Now, it is very important to note that companies may be concerned about reverse discrimination lawsuits, but the majority of litigation still relates to the more traditional forms of discrimination. So that's really, you know, really important to note. What we're seeing in the human capital management sphere is that diversity-related proposals, I think I just mentioned it, but they really dominate the human capital management category. So you do see that there's continued pressure from shareholders on this topic.
Yeah, so they're trying to, the shareholders and the activists are trying to get companies to sort of follow, you know, what's happening in academia, but to continue to increase diversity, equity, and inclusion. So now one place that that's also a focus is on the directors of the company. Let's talk about those director elections. What are you seeing in 2024 so far in director elections? And, you know, how does that compare to past years?
Yeah. So the current level of support for directors is high at 95%. That's really high. Last year in 2023, the average level of support was 94%. So that indicates that companies are doing a real good job of explaining in their proxy season, in their proxy statement, and through other communications, the value that their directors bring to the table. What I will continue to recommend is for companies to review their directors' qualifications and their disclosures on those qualifications, especially for vulnerable directors, for example, directors with lower votes last year or that may be longer tenured. So it continues to be very important for companies to look at those disclosures. What we did see last year, and I checked this year, it's actually reversing, but Last year, the effort support for the NumGov committee chair fell below the 90% threshold. And we heard from investors that that was due to, or that they are increasingly voting against the NumGov committee chair due to their concerns with not every company, but some companies' governance practices and board diversity, just level of board diversity.
Yeah, and a lot of that was that the companies, in a lot of cases, still have a combined chair and CEO.
Yeah.
And so you get a lot of withhold votes on the NumGov committee chair because of that. But, you know, increasingly, they have independent lead directors who, you know, accomplish what these folks are trying to accomplish. So there's a bit of a tension there still, isn't there?
Yes. Yes. And so that definitely is one of the reasons. But the lack of board diversity is also something that investors are increasingly frustrated with at some companies, not all companies, obviously.
Well, because in the S&P 500, of course, you know, we're well above 30% women directors. And I think the number is 12-15% diverse directors. So that's a material change just over the past few years. So
yes,
a lot of progress here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, like you said, the S&P 500 definitely is a leading force there. You see that the governance practices at smaller companies really sometimes trail the best practices at larger companies.
Yeah, I think I think your point is a really good one, which is that the largest companies are probably the furthest along in these changes. But, you know, when you get down to the Russell 2000 and 3000 companies, it really, they've lagged. And so those companies do need, and those boards need to, you know, kind of pick up the pace here, or they're gonna get activists. Now, there are three committees that are defined and required by the SEC: Audit, Comp, and Nominating and Governance Committee. You talked about NumGov. Talk about what you're seeing in Audit and Comp.
Yeah, Audit has held steady. So effort support for Audit Committee chairs has held steady above 90%. So we don't see any concerns there. What we did here, and this is anecdotal, the same is for comp committee chairs. So they were, I believe, at 92 average support last year and are still above the 90% threshold. What we did hear from investors is that they're increasingly coupling concerns related to say on pay with votes for the comp committee chair. So especially companies with problematic pay packages or low say on pay votes see investors vote against their comp committee chair. So that's really something that companies should be aware of.
Yeah. So those are those trends. And, you know, this has just changed over time. I mean, at one point, audit committee chairs were getting attacked for practices that, you know, people have conformed those and that stopped. And then it was compensation. That's, you see less of that. And now, as you said, the NumGov chairs are, you know, being targeted for those practices. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that cycle through over time and that boards need to continually be cognizant of. Now, let's turn to shareholder engagement. In your report, you know, the big institutional investors are really trying to come to a common point of view, you know, on all of these pro and anti ESG measures. Talk about what the status is on, you know, pro and con ESG.
What we're seeing is that both companies and investors are under intense pressure from groups on both ends of the political aisle, so pro and anti ESG. And so, for example, for companies, you see it in they're getting proposals that are a little extremer and that not necessarily meant to effectuate change at the company, but that are meant to draw attention, basically to create headlines. Because even though these proposals really get very low support, single digit numbers of support, they do get a lot of attention in, you know, just in the regular news. So those proponents are really using the shareholder voting process basically for their own purposes, not necessarily to, as I said, to bring about change.
It, you know, and it's a national debate here in the US, but it's also, you know, a debate that's happening elsewhere in the world. But, you know, it's a question of, you know, the pendulum swing. You know, there was just so little focus on DEI, you know, policies and ESG issues. And then there's this hyper focus on it. And then the question is it too much? And so you get these people saying, you know, this so-called backlash and on DEI. And but it's really, I think, just society trying to find, you know, some sort of equilibrium. And companies are sitting kind of in the middle of all of this because they're trying to follow the rules. They're trying to do the right thing. And those shifting sands are different year on year. Yeah, it makes it very hard for boards of directors.
It's very tricky, yeah. And so what we recommend companies and investors to do, or what we've seen, what they're already doing, is really try to find middle ground. So really, you know, focus their discussions on those ESG topics and those proposals that are meaningful and that can actually provide long-term value. Companies should be just very, very sure to have a clear and consistent message in all of their communications, in all of their engagement, no matter with which side they are engaging. They should try to link any of their positions to shareholder value. And they should really, as I already mentioned, they should be sure to follow through on commitments.
Well, and this goes to the final point in your report, which is that there needs to be engagement between the companies, the boards, and their investors, because, you know, you need to have this dialogue to figure out where this common ground is and what the issues are, because at the end of the day, there needs to be a consensus between the boards of directors and shareholders as to, you know, what the right way is to govern these companies, so that there isn't this constant tension, right?
Exactly. And yeah, this year is really a break. It looks like this year is a break from the past, where because the investors and companies are under such pressures, such extreme pressures, they are finding each other more.
Yeah, and I think you see, boards of directors or certain members of the board engaging directly with shareholders. And I, you know, that's valuable as well, not just management. So I think all of this, and, you know, when I look back over the past, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, it's just been a sea change of practices over time. And we, you know, we continue to, you know, to deal with this year to year. So an important report. Meryl Sperring, thanks so much for sharing a little bit of that report. And I think you can find it on the Conference Board's website, right? tcb.org, if you want to read the full report.
Absolutely. And I think even on the website where this podcast is posted.
Meryl, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.